So I will, in this lecture, say something about banking, but before I get to banking, I still want to add a few few remarks, some loose ends concerning money. First, a remark about the proposal that has been made by many people that instead of having something like a gold standard or a silver standard, we should have what they call a commodity reserve money. That is a money that is not backed by gold or silver, but by a bundle of goods that is backed by a ton of oil, three pounds of butter, five bikes, and things like this. It is easy to see what is awkward about this proposal. I should mention, for instance, various Chicago economists, older Chicago economists, have proposed something like this. What's wrong with this can be immediately recognized by asking the question, can titles to bundles of goods be money? And the answer is no, because bundles of goods are by definition less saleable than the most saleable of the of a component of this bundle. And again, recall, the purpose of money is, so to speak, to be the most easily saleable of all commodities. Now, a bundle of commodities is always more difficult to sale than the most saleable element of a bundle. For this reason, so-called proposals for commodity reserve money should be discounted as somehow counterintuitive, counterproductive to the very purpose of money. A second remark concerns a proposal that has been made by Hayek in a book that's called The Denationalization of Money, where he proposes, okay, government gets out of the business of money producing, which is, of course, also the view of the mainstream within the Austrian school. But Hayek's idea is there should be multiple issuers of paper monies. And they should compete against each other by building up a reputation for stabilizing their currency in a sufficient way. So the idea is something like there should be Hoppe money, Hülsmann money, Mises money, Rothbard money, and so forth, each of which supposedly is a paper money. Now, this is, so to speak, a crackpot idea. What is crackpot about it is that when you try to introduce these paper monies, then at that moment, nobody has any idea of what the purchasing power of a 10 unit Hoppe money is, or a 10 unit Hülsmann money is, or a 10 unit Rothbard money is. So they cannot be initially accepted at all. What Hayek here misunderstands or has not really recognized fully is Mises's insight that any type of money must initially be a commodity money traded in barter, because only then do people have an idea of what the initial purchasing power of this commodity is, and then additional purchasing power is added to it as soon as this commodity is also demanded for the very first time as a medium of exchange. That is, in order to start a money, people must have an idea of what it is that you get for it. And in order to get this idea, it is necessary that that thing was first also used in barter and could buy something in barter. This way you can form an idea of what you get for an egg, what you get for an apple, and so forth. Pure paper monies can never get off the ground. So this Hayek proposal should be discarded as being a crackpot idea. The third remark concerns the idea that some people like Milton Friedman have proposed about national paper currencies, with the claim that there exist, so to speak, optimal currency areas, that there should not be necessarily a worldwide used money. Now this idea also seems to me to be entirely mistaken. And that can also be easily recognized by recognizing that national borders are, of course, artificial. They have, in a way, no economic meaning. If you go back in history, you find that borders have been drawn in a completely different way. Sometimes countries have been enlarged, sometimes countries have been split up into a larger number of units. Just imagine for a second we would have a massive secessionist movement going on and would all of a sudden have 3,000 different countries, each of these countries having their own paper currency. Now, would this be an advantage? And the answer is no, this would be almost throwing us back into a system of barter. Trading now between these 3,000 different entities would be enormously complicated. It is a huge advantage if we just don't have a large number of different currencies, but one or two covering the entire world. And the idea of an optimal currency area, short of the world, is just as idiotic as the idea of an optimal trading area. The optimal trading area is also the entire world. We cannot say it is optimal that only Germans trade among Germans and not with Danes, and Danes not with people living in Iceland. No, the optimal solution is indeed that the entire globe participates in the division of labor, and the optimal currency area is also the entire world, one and the same currency being used all over the world. The last remark, again directed against Friedman, concerns the idea that opponents of commodity money standards such as the gold standard or the silver standard, opponents such as Friedman in particular, have always argued against commodity monies and in favor of a paper money by pointing out this. Don't we, when we use a gold standard or a silver standard, use many useful resources in order to dig out gold out of the ground, silver out of the ground? And couldn't we use all of these resources that are currently devoted to the production of these metals, couldn't we devote these resources, whatever, to produce bread or milk or beer or something that would give immediate satisfaction to people? So he calls this a waste of resources comes about by favoring a commodity money standard. Now I want to show that there are several arguments, several points wrong in this argument. The most important one is this: if we have a national paper money instead of a commodity money, then this national paper money must be produced by a monopolist. That is, we cannot have competition in the area of producing dollar bills. If there would be competition in the area of producing dollar bills, then we would immediately have hyperinflation. So we must restrict the production of dollar bills to one monopoly institution, and all others must be outlawed from it. But we know, of course, from monopoly theory that whenever a monopolist produces a product, he tends to produce it at higher cost and at lower quality than would be brought about under competitive conditions. If you are the only producer that can produce money, then you can raise your cost almost to the sky. Look, it costs almost nothing to print a note. And that would cost, of course, become manifest as soon as everybody would be able to go into this business. That's why the purchasing power of this type of money would basically fall to zero, because it costs zero to produce it. But if you are a monopolist, you can just basically just pay yourself as a producer of this money astronomical salaries. That is, you can produce something that can be produced at almost zero cost, also at exorbitant costs, because nobody can go into competition against you. The operation of the Federal Reserve System in the United States is enormously costly. As I said, they employ tens of thousands of economists at huge salaries. They all drive business class whenever they fly someplace. These are also all costs. I think the cost might be well higher than all the costs that were ever used in order to dig gold out of the ground. In addition, you create, by producing paper money, far more uncertainty about what will be the future quantity of money. As long as gold is money, people have some rough idea what sort of gold findings there are, how much you can find here and there, and you have a certain amount of predictive capability of what the future will bring. When it comes to predicting what the future quantity of paper money will be, not even Alan Greenspan knows that right now. Tomorrow something might happen and they say, oh, we need such and such an increase in it, and so forth. So enormous increase in the in uncertainty, financial uncertainty is brought about, and this leads to large numbers of institutions, financial advisors, various types of hedge funds, and so forth, that come into existence that otherwise would not have come into existence at all. And these funds and these investment advisors also use up quite a bit of resources. And because of the financial uncertainty, gold becomes an inflation hedge. And if we look, for instance, at the gold prices, then we find that while we were under the gold standard, the price of gold was $35 per ounce of gold at the point when the United States went off the gold standard. In the meantime, you know that the price of gold is in the neighborhood of $450 per ounce of gold, indicating that there is likely more gold being mined now than there was at the time when it was $35. It is interesting that the older Friedman, in an article in 1988, realized all this. So he went back and said, you know, my main argument before paper money standard was this resource savings argument. And then he just admits all of these things that I mentioned here, and that I was wrong in all of this. Now, Friedman's methodology is, you die with your predictions. So he made the prediction it will lower the resource costs. Now he admits it actually raised the resource costs to have a paper money. But was Milton Friedman willing to just say, I was wrong and the gold standard was better than what we currently have? No way. So they don't even follow their own methodological prescriptions when it doesn't fit into their preconceived scheme. He admits that he was all wrong, but says, yeah, but nonetheless, we have to stick with the paper money. So now I want to come to banking. And there exist basically two types of banks, traditionally two types of banks that were institutionally actually separated, in modern times have become integrated into one institution. The first one is what we call savings and loan institutions. Savings and loan institutions are characterized by the fact that we have a saver who hands over property of his for some time, specified time, over to the bank. And the bank hands over the property that they received from the saver to some borrower. And the bank makes its money from the interest differential. That is the interest that they pay the savers on the one hand and the interest that they charge the borrowers on the other hand. And competition between the savings and loan institutions would see to it that this differential between interest paid to savers and interest charged to borrowers will tend to be a minimum difference. Notice also that all credit that is given to borrowers by these types of institutions is what we can call commodity credit. In the following sense, the savers, by giving up ownership for certain periods of time in money handed over to the bank, have indeed abstained from using some available real resources. And these available real resources that they have abstained from using are now handed over, so to speak, to the borrowers. They can, so to speak, engage now in investment projects and pay their workers, so to speak, with those goods that the savers abstained from using. This is an important point that will come out when we later on will talk about the business cycle theory, because in the business cycle theory, large parts or parts of the loans being extended to investors are not commodity credit, but are instead fiduciary credit or circulation credit, as Mises points it out. That is, credit that are simply created out of thin air by printing up additional banknotes that are offered for loan purposes, but without anybody having actually abstained from consuming any goods, without commodities backing these credits. So genuine loan and savings banks only hand over to the borrowers goods that other people have indeed abstained using and make these goods free for investment purposes by the borrowers. savings and loan banking has no influence on the money supply. It does not increase the money supply at all. Money is just transferred from one hand to the other and returned. No increase in the money supply results from the institution of savings and loan banks. Savings and loan banks also do not have to hold any reserves because no one in a savings and loan bank has a right to come at any time and have their deposits redeemed. They enter a time contract, and the bank has only the obligation to pay up once these time contracts are expired. So a savings and loan bank can do with zero reserves only at the time when their obligations fall due. Then they must have, of course, the money in order to repay to their savers. The second type of banking is deposit banking. As I said, institutionally that developed actually separately out of goldsmiths who provided safekeeping services for people who wanted to put their gold at safer places than their own kitchen table. And since they had vaults, they were the preferred people to go and deposit your money for safekeeping purposes. In deposit banking, there is no transfer of property that takes place. The depositor does not give up his property. He only hands it over to the bank for safekeeping purposes. This is called a bailment contract. There's not a loan extended to the bank. The bank cannot count that among as its assets, the gold that was deposited there. In the same way as if you deposit your furniture, let's say you move from one place to another, you deposit your furniture in a furniture warehouse, and then you get tickets. Then the furniture warehouse would also not, in its book, list your furniture as assets of the furniture warehouse. They remain in your possession. You pay a deposit fee for this service that they do, and the income of the bank is this deposit fee. There's again, because of competition in this institution of deposit banks, a tendency that these fees tend to be minimum fees. People go to banks that charge lower fees, other things being the same, and avoid to go to banks that charge lower fees. These warehouses, these deposit banks, give you a ticket. The ticket can be redeemed at any time you want, at any time when the bank is open, during opening times, of course. And the circulation of these tickets is in some way limited. Yes, people can accept these tickets as payments, but one has to be aware of the fact that the tickets will be redeemed at par only to the extent that the fee has in fact been paid. That is, if you receive a ticket and then after 5 years you present your ticket and want your gold out of the bank, deposit fees were only paid for 2 or 3 months, then of course you will not get your tickets redeemed at par, but there will be extra fees for safekeeping charged, which means that by and large there will be a constant tendency for people to quickly redeem their tickets into gold in order to avoid this these late payments of fees that otherwise would result. Again, deposit banks also have no influence on the money supply as long as they hold 100% reserves. That is, for every ticket there is the equivalent amount of gold in the bank. Then the only thing that takes place is, so to speak, a change in the composition of money. Whenever you deposit gold, an equivalent sum of money certificates or money substitutes will enter circulation. And whenever you get your gold out, then the equivalent amount of money substitutes will be drawn out of circulation. So the composition of money, the form of money changes. There can be more genuine money and less substitutes in circulation, or vice versa. But deposit banking in and of itself has also no influence on the money supply. Then we come to fractional reserve banking. And fractional reserve banking is in some way, so to speak, a confusion between savings and deposit banks. The institution of fractional reserve banking arose simply out of the observation that deposit bankers made that not all ticket holders would come at the same time and wanted to have their tickets redeemed, that there was always a certain amount of gold that remained in the banks. And based on this observation, they then came up with the idea, oh yeah, why not print additional tickets that are backed by nothing and loan them out against interest, and hope that these things have been repaid before all people will appear. It should be clear that what the consequences of this type of practice are. First, from a legal point of view, by printing additional tickets, you have now more than one owner of the same quantity of gold stored in the bank. You have, so to speak, two title holders, even though you have no more gold in the bank than you had before. So this would be a legal conflict that would manifest itself, that if both of these individuals came to the bank at the same time, both could not be satisfied, obviously. It also has an economic effect. The economic effect is, again, something that Guido Hülsmann will talk about more when he talks about the business cycle theory. Because some of the money is now, that is loaned out, is of course invested in some producer goods, which cannot be instantly liquidated and brought back into the form of money. And this is, so to speak, a characteristic of the business, of a business cycle situation. That there's a mismatch in timing. Some people think it is immediately available, and in fact it is bound up in time-consuming processes which cannot be stopped instantly, and the invested goods be reverted back into the original form of money. In addition, of course, any type of fractional reserve banking will increase the money supply. There are additional titles created without a corresponding amount of gold or silver or whatever the money commodity is being drawn out of circulation. And in being in additional sums of money being created, it has redistributive effects of the kind that I explained before. Those people who get the money first gain at the expense of people who get the money last. Fractional reserve banking has been in all countries by the courts recognized as legal. Despite the fact that in all other walks of life, if you would do something like fractional reserve practices, it is treated as fraud. So if I would do what a fractional reserve bank does, for instance, with in a furniture warehouse, that is rely on the fact that not all people who have deposited their furniture at my warehouse come at the same time and loan out Mr. Berking's chairs for some ongoing party in the hope that the party will be over and the chairs will be returned to my warehouse before he arrives there and wants to get his chairs back, that would be considered fraud. In the case of banking, it is not considered to be a fraudulent activity. In the case of furniture warehouses, to engage in this type of activity is also a little bit more difficult, I should mention, because furnitures are not what is called fungible goods, whereas money is fungible. That is, if you come and want your money back and your money is not there, they can give you the money of somebody else. And you don't care as long as you get the same sum of money. If Mr. Berking comes and wants his chairs back, and the guy says, you know, unfortunately your chairs are not here, but I have Mr. Miller's chairs. Why don't you take those? Then the problem is, of course, that he might just have a personal attachment to his chairs because his grandmother left a specific smell on her chairs, and Mr. Miller has a completely different smell, and these smells are incompatible. Then the fraud becomes, of course, more apparent than if it is just money, because, as you know, money doesn't stink. So now we come to free banking. Free banking is a system of freely competing commercial banks, each of which is permitted to engage in fractional reserve banking. There has been some debate over whether it is appropriate to call such a system free banking. Some debate about the word free. Because, you know, when we refer to the free market, we also do not think that everything is permitted on the free market. The free market is not a system where everybody can do whatever he wants. The free market does not allow that I hit you on the head, that I steal your wallet and rape and pillage and things like that. The free market is characterized by the fact that people within their rights, with their property, engage in free exchanges. Free banking, however, as I indicated before, it is very doubtful whether that is really part of the free market, because there seems to be some sort of fraudulent element involved in the whole thing from the outset, because after all, there are two people who have at the same time title to the same object. Let me go a moment astray and just illustrate this by another example. Let's say you go to a car lot and you buy yourself a car, but you don't take possession of the car. You just, because your garage has not been completed, you just leave it on the car lot. But you do get the title. And then somebody else comes to the car lot and he sees your car standing around there. And the car dealer then sells your car a second time, because after all, your car is still there. And all he has to do is print another title. So now there are two title holders. You have a title to the car, and the other guy has also a title to the car, but there is actually only one car there. Is that fraud? In all other walks of life, this is, of course, fraud. In any case, what is the advantage and disadvantage of a system of free banking? The advantage as compared to a monopolistic system of monopolistic banking is simply this. Under a system of free banking, the fraud will be comparatively limited. For one reason that I already explained, namely that as soon as one bank realizes that another bank has issued too many fake receipts, they can point that out to their clients and there will be a bank run ensuing. So it is dangerous for a bank to engage in such an activity because your competitors might take advantage of this weakness of yours. Secondly, there exists what is called adverse clearing under free banking. So if one bank issues fake notes, notes covered by nothing, then as long as these fake notes would only circulate among its own clients, nothing more dramatic happens than that, of course, a bank run can occur. But no bank can, of course, be sure that its own fake notes, its own money substitutes that are covered by nothing, will only circulate among its own clients. They will eventually end up in the hands of a client of a different bank. And this client will then approach his bank and deposit these fake tickets. And what will the bank where these fake tickets have been deposited do? They will, of course, immediately go to the bank that issued these tickets and ask for the real thing. That is, hand me over the gold or the silver or whatever it is. And as soon as that is the case, then the relative solvency of the bank that issued these fake notes dwindles. It has all of a sudden far less reserves than it previously had and becomes in a more and more precarious situation. For this reason, free banks will tend to hold relatively high reserves, not 100%, but also not, as some people claim, I think White and Selgin, reserves that go approach zero. I think Mises is right that they will tend to hold high reserves. Nonetheless, from the point of view of bankers, of course, this is not a sufficient solution. Bankers like to inflate. After all, by printing fake notes, they can earn interest on it. So that they have to hold high reserves is something undesirable. They would rather hold no reserves at all. So what can they do in order to reach this goal? And in order to reach this goal, they have to establish a central bank. And contrary to some myths, the establishment of central banks has, in almost all cases, been ardently supported by all major banking houses. It was the major banking houses of the Morgans and the Rockefellers and so forth in the United States that were behind the founding of the American Central Bank in 1913. And what is created with a central bank is basically a system where you can engage in coordinated inflation. So here you have the central bank, and then you have the commercial banks who use the central bank just as we use commercial banks. That is, this, all commercial banks have accounts in the central bank just as you and me have accounts in the various commercial banks. So indirectly, we are now all clients of the central bank, one step removed. You recall, before the problem in the way of inflating at will for a system of free banking was that we were not all clients of the same bank. Now we do become clients of the same bank, and it becomes easier to inflate, starting with the central bank and then coordinated inflation being instituted by the various commercial banks. And how does this system now operate? I should first point this out. Under, they all operate, of course, under fractional reserves. So as long as we had the gold standard, so at the bottom of the pyramid you had gold, then you had a larger amount of Federal Reserve notes, so your dollar notes, for instance, the notes that are issued by the central bank. The pyramid indicates, of course, that all these notes cannot be redeemed in gold because there are far more notes than gold. And then on top of that, you have checkbook money or demand deposits that that the commercial banks can pile. And again, all demand deposit accounts that exist in the commercial banks can also not redeem into existing Fed notes. Currently, of course, this has dropped out, plays no role anymore. But if we would all go and wanted to dissolve our demand deposit accounts and wanted to have all what we allegedly own in our demand deposit accounts paid out in cash, the entire banking system would be bankrupt. No bank has this amount. Currently, of course, this is not a big problem because there would be a bank holiday instituted, and then the Fed, which is the lender of last resort, more appropriate would be counterfeiter, printer of last resort. They can then, of course, print any amount of notes in order to fulfill all obligations. You realize why it was that they had to get rid of that gold stuff, because as much as they try to do miracles, the amount of gold they could, of course, not after a bank holiday come up with. But the amount of Fed notes and the amount of Danish kronas and so forth, they can come up with after a few days. But again, if you go to all of your Danish banks, take all of your demand deposit accounts out, every single bank in Denmark would be broke. All would have to close their doors. Now, how does this system then operate? How's the money supply influenced? There are two major factors. One is the what we call the reserve requirements. That is regulated in different places differently, sometimes by law, sometimes by custom. That is simply how many reserves as compared with outstanding obligations a bank is supposed to have. Let's say 10%. That would mean that for every $100 of demand deposit accounts, they would have to have $10 in cash. $90 they would not have. That is a fraction that is not covered. If we look at what happens to reserve requirements have, by and large, if we look over history, have been continuously reduced. When the American system was introduced, the reserve requirements were something like 20%. Then during World War I, central banks are also very nice instruments in order to finance wars. You know, so if you finance wars, you either have to raise taxes, which takes a while, and people might give you trouble. But if you have a central bank, war finance becomes very easy. You just simply lower your reserve requirements from 20% to 10%, and thereby you double the money supply from one day to the next. This is, for instance, what the Americans did during World War I, which most other countries did similar things. And the second element that has an influence on the money supply, so reserve requirements going up, meaning always the money supply is increased, with the effects that I already explained, government always benefiting itself at the expense of the public. The second effect, the second element that has an influence on reserves, on the total money supply, are what we call total reserves. Reserves is money deposited in the banks. And on the reserves, two institutions have an influence. On the one hand, the public, and on the other hand, the Federal Reserve, that is the central bank. The public has an influence on the total reserves by either depositing money in the banks or withdrawing money in the banks. If they deposit money in the banks and get a demand deposit, or so if they deposit money in the bank, then the reserves in the banking system go up, and as reserves in the banking system go up, then the banking system can increase its demand deposit by a positive multiple of this increase in reserves. That is, if we as a whole deposit on net 10 additional dollars in the banking system, then the banking system can create an additional $90 of demand deposits out of thin air and loan that out, okay, under a 10% reserve requirement. If we put $100 in net into the banking system, then an additional $900 can be created out of thin air on top of this. So the public depositing money in the bank means the money supply will be increased by a positive multiple of this deposit. Under 100% reserve banking, of course, it would have no effect on the money supply. Under fractional reserve banking, it leads to an increase by a positive multiple of the money supply. The reverse happens if we withdraw money from the bank. Banks do not like to see that happen, because if we withdraw money from the bank, then the reserves in the banking system go down, and they must now shrink their money supply by a positive multiple of this withdrawal. To give you some examples, for instance, that have an effect on these changes in the public, what they do with reserves or not. For instance, as long as the drug market is illegal, there is a greater demand for cash. Imagine, for instance, drugs would be completely legalized. What effect would that have on the money supply? Now, people would now deposit the money in the bank. They would pay their drug dealer with checks instead of with cash. So the money supply would increase by a positive multiple of the net. Of the net deposits. If they would just outlaw the drinking of beer and smoking of cigarettes, then of course the demand for cash would increase, the money supply would fall by a multiple of these net withdrawals. What's the influence that the Fed has on total reserves? I only want to mention the most standard tool that the Fed uses, that is open market operations. Of which there exist two: open market purchases and open market sales. What are open market operations? Open market operations are simply the central bank goes into the open market and buys something or sells something. Most of the time, for reasons that will become apparent, most of the time they buy something. Typically they buy existing government bonds, but at least in the United States they are not obliged to do that. They can in principle buy anything they want. They can buy, for instance, a Mercedes. So how do they pay for the Mercedes? They pay for the Mercedes by creating a check out of thin air, drawn on the central bank. They simply write, drawn central bank, $100,000, and then they pay that to the Mercedes seller. Now what does the Mercedes seller then do? The Mercedes seller banks, of course, not with a central bank. Nobody banks with a central bank except the commercial banks. So he goes to his commercial bank and presents them with his $100,000 check drawn on the central bank. And the commercial bank then approaches the central bank, and they have demand deposit accounts at the central bank, just as we have demand deposit accounts here. So this bank then gets credited with $100,000. Reserves have now in the banking system as a whole gone up by $100,000. And if the reserves have gone up by $100,000 at the reserve requirement of 10%, the banking system as a whole is now allowed to create $900,000 additional dollars worth in demand deposit accounts. How do they create them? Again, they create them out of thin air. So you see, the banking system is a system that is rarely fully understood. It is actually quite simple to understand, but once you understand it, most people shake their heads and can't believe that such a thing is tolerated. Okay, that should end my beloved banking lecture.
if you have a 100% reserve requirement, then that would just mean that the interest rate margin you had to require for a loan would be much higher, so it would be much more expensive to loan money.
Yeah, but it would be an interest rate that would be determined by genuine savings. You see, like, yes, by printing up money, I can temporarily lower the interest rate, but not in the long run, because there will be then eventually, because that involves an increase in the money supply, and that will appear as an inflation premium in the form of higher prices, and the interest rate will then eventually adjust to the real interest rate again.
Just the real interest rate would change by the amount of capital you have to hold. When you have 100% reserve requirement and say that you have some cost of equity, meaning the cost of holding capital, that translates directly over to a margin on the real interest rate on your loan.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is...
Under
fractional reserve banking, what takes place is, so to speak, a temporary falsification of the real interest rate. If you have 100% reserve deposit banking plus savings and loan banking, the interest rate reflects, so to speak, always the real interest rate. Fractional reserve banking falsifies for a temporary period what the real interest rate is. It gives the impression that there has been more, that there is more savings than there really is. Again, recall I explained that under savings and loan banking, the loans that are extended are really backed up by goods that the savers themselves have sacrificed not to use. That is, if I give you a dollar for a year, that means that I abstain from, let's say, buying a Coke right now. And you can buy the Coke. Okay? And you can drink the Coke while you are working on some investment project. Okay. Under fractional reserve banking, the situation is different. The bank prints up an additional dollar that they give you as a loan. But there is no person who has abstained from drinking the Coke.
That's why it's so much cheaper.
Yeah, but that's why it also causes trouble. Because now I still want to drink the Coke because I have not abstained from drinking the Coke, and you want the Coke at the same time also. You see the problem? It's like if you engage in an investment project, these investment projects can then not all be completed because there are just not enough saved up funds there in order to feed the workers during that time.
But isn't that just a one-time increase in the price level, and then you have adjusted, and then it still works out the same way?
Yes, the price level will then eventually go up.
And we have had that increase in the price level.
As the price level goes up, then of course the interest rate will build an inflation premium into it also, and then the interest rate adjusts to its actual height.
Yeah,
but in the meantime, trouble has occurred.
Yeah, but since we have already had this reserve requirement for many years, I mean, the price level has adjusted many years ago, so now it's simply a question of now you can loan money for a lower interest rate.
Yeah, but it goes on and on and on. It's like, as we sit here, they extend further and further and further of these cheap loans.
Well, it's not that the money growth rate is increasing. I mean, it's pretty constant over the years, so it could be held pretty constant. But if you required a 100% reserve requirement, you would still have to charge a much higher real interest rate on your loans. It's simply the cost of providing the funds for the loans is much higher.
Look, the interest rate is just a price like any other price. Actually, it's a more important price because it affects, so to speak, the economy as a whole. The interest rate should also be determined by the supply of savings and the demand for savings. Only that is, so to speak, a correct price. Everything else is just some sort of price control that you introduce. You can, of course, you can artificially lower the price of milk. What do you get when you artificially lower the price of milk? You get more people wanting to buy milk
like
at the shop, and then eventually,
the price.
Yes, it is.
This is an increase in productivity.
No, it isn't.
You're simply able to produce loans more productively.
No, it
isn't. So this is an
No, you don't produce more loans. You just produce more paper. That's the point. You don't produce more.
The cost of producing loans.
Real loans are commodity loans. That is, you have an abstract from money for a moment. Just think of a barter economy, and think of what would loans consist of in a barter economy. In a barter economy, if I would give you a loan, I would give you real things. Okay, I give you my coat, I give you my drinks, I give you my meat, and so forth. And then you can just do something with these real things. Okay, in a barter economy, loans can be extended also. You admit that, right? They are then real goods. Okay. In a monetary economy, by abstaining from using money, by handing it over for the bank to a certain extent, what you do is exactly the same as in a barter economy. You also basically give goods to those who receive the loan, except they are unspecified goods. It's not my suit. What he does with the money, he buys it, might buy the suit, or he might buy her shirt, or he might buy that coffee machine. I do not know what he will buy. But nonetheless, they are real things that I give them. On the other hand, if I print up an additional ticket and nobody has saved one more bit than before, then of course I extend more credit than there really is. There is not more savings. I only create the illusion that there is more savings. And because I create the illusion that there is more savings, more investment projects will be begun, but not all investment projects can be completed because of a lack of genuine savings. But I think this will be the subject of the lecture on business cycles. I'm only touching upon that. That is, so to speak, the main drift of the lecture on business cycles. I mean, I can give that lecture too, but I have decided that Guido should do that. So I'll ask you to wait until Guido Hülsmann will give his lecture on business cycles to make that perfectly clear what fundamental difference there is between artificially manipulated interest rates through extension of fiduciary or circulation credit as compared to a regular expansion which takes place due to increased genuine savings on the part of the public.
I also have some questions. Do you consider it fraud when an airline company with, say, 100 seats from a destination A to B sells 110 tickets because they expect that not all customers will show up? Is it fraud if they tell the customers, we sell more tickets than we have?
No.
And if you... if there is, if more people show up, then you cannot come on
no,
the plane. You'll get some kind of refund.
I can. Let me. On the one hand, let me just make you aware of one of my articles. It's called "Against Fiduciary Media" in the first issue of the first volume of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, where I deal with with this in great detail, which is available on the internet through Mises.org. But to be brief, no, the airline does not promise you now that you will get a seat. The bank, the fractional reserve bank, you can come at any time and get it. That is what it makes it fraudulent. The airline does not commit a fraud when they say, we will transport you in a week, and they oversell right now. They are not committing a fraud right now. So this is something entirely different from the promise, everybody can come right now. If the airline would say, we are standing here right now, you are ready to board, and then they oversell, then it would be fraud. Look, the airline could, in 10 days, they might have a second airplane there. And they are willing, of course, to buy you off. So it is different what sort of promise they make. They do not make the promise, you can come at any time you want. They say, you can come in 1 week. And in 1 week, they might well be able to satisfy all demands. Okay, thank you again. Give me 5 more minutes and then my last lecture for today.